God created Vara, the Taninim. Therefore, since Vara indicates the defining of a role and function in the ordered system, one might conclude that the Taninim must therefore be good. On the other hand, they perhaps don't need to be good just because they are in the ordered system. This issue requires more nuanced investigation. If this interpretation is correct, it first of all confirms the overall interpretation that I have offered of Genesis chapter 1, that it concerns the setting up of a functional, ordered system, the home story, not the house story. Second, it does not suggest that everything pre-fall is perfect. God has established a modicum of order adequate for our survival and for His plan to unfold. There is still a long way to go before the ultimate order of new creation is achieved. People are supposed to be part of that ordering process as vice-regents. Some non-order remains and will eventually be resolved, but the order that has been established is functional, good, and there is not yet disorder. This conclusion can be confirmed further by some of the other occurrences of the designation Tov Me'od, very good. For example, the same description is given to the Promised Land, Numbers, chapter 14, verse 7, though it is filled with enemies and wicked inhabitants, not to mention wild animals who are predators. Consequently, we cannot deduce, on the basis of this word alone, that the pre-fall world could not have included pain, suffering, predation, or death. We could feasibly find reason to draw such conclusions based on other statements of Scripture, and we will explore those in due time. But the mere use of the word Tov does not warrant these conclusions. To assume otherwise would not be interpreting the text literally. It would be reading into the text that which is not represented in the word the author used. It would be a case of imposing our own meaning on the word with no regard to what the text was communicating. This good condition is not necessarily absent of experiences or situations that we perceive as negative, though sin has not yet made its entrance. Likewise, we cannot deduce that Adam and Eve were specimens of humanity who were perfect in every way. The writings of both the rabbis and the church fathers are filled with expositions of the supreme wisdom and righteousness of these two humans before the fall. But this condition is neither insinuated in the text nor corroborated by the text, and alternative opinions are also pervasive in the history of interpretation. Proposition 6. Adam is used in Genesis chapters 1 to 5 in a variety of ways. Understanding the varied use of the term Adam is essential to sorting out the early chapters of Genesis. But before we even get to that issue, there are two important observations to make. The first is that the word Adam is a Hebrew word meaning human. Regarding this observation, the fact that it is Hebrew indicates that the category designation, human, is imposed by those who spoke Hebrew. Adam and Eve would not have called each other these names because whatever they spoke, it was not Hebrew. Hebrew does not exist as a language until somewhere in the middle of the second millennium B.C. That means that these names are not just a matter of historical reporting, as if their names just happened to be Adam and Eve like someone else's name is Bill or Mary. Although I believe that Adam and Eve are historical personages, real people in a real past, these cannot be their historical names. The names are Hebrew, and there is no Hebrew at the point in time when Adam and Eve lived. If these are not historical names, then they must be assigned names, intended by the Hebrew-speaking users to convey a particular meaning. Such a deduction leads us to the second observation. In English, if we find that someone's name is human, and his partner's name is Life, we quickly develop an impression of what is being communicated. As, for example, in Pilgrim's Progress, where characters are named Christian, Faithful, and Hopeful. These characters, by virtue of their assigned names, are larger than the historical characters to whom they refer. They represent something beyond themselves. Consequently, we can see from the start that interpretation may not be straightforward. More is going on than giving some biographical information about two people in history. In terms of the variety of uses of these words in Genesis chapters 1 to 5, we find that, in some cases, Adam refers to human beings as a species. In others, it refers to the male individual of the species. And in some, it refers to the designation of a particular individual as the equivalent of a personal name. Morphologically, meaning by form, the single distinction is whether it has a definite article, equals the, attached or not. When it has the definite article, it cannot be understood as a personal name. Hebrew does not use a definite article on personal names. Syntactically, for example, by its role in the sentence, the single distinction is whether it is treated as a corporate plurality or as a singular being. The following data summarize the use of the word Adam in the book of Genesis. 22 times with definite article. Genesis, chapter 1, verse 27, chapter 2, verse 7, 2 times, verses 8, 15, 16, 18, 19, 2 times, 20, 21, 22, 2 times, 23, 25, chapter 3, verses 8, 9, 12, 20, 22, 24, chapter 4, verse 1. 3 times with the attached preposition. Genesis, chapter 2, verse 20, chapter 3, verses 17 and 21. 9 times with no definite article or preposition. Genesis, chapter 1, verse 26, chapter 2, verse 5, chapter 4, verse 25, chapter 5, verse 1, 2 times, verses 2, 3, 4, and 5. The interpretation of most of these data is largely uncomplicated, but a few difficulties are encountered. The major irregularities are as follows. It seems unusual that the indefinite form is used in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, then the definite article is used in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. This is further complicated when the latter half of the verse refers first to the singular. He created him, Hebrew, New English Version, them. And then to the plural, male and female, he created them. Taking our lead from Genesis chapter 2, verse 5, where the context indicates a generic sense, we would understand Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 as generic. God said, "Let us make generic humanity, the human species, in our image." Note that this coincides with previous creative acts of living beings. God created animals, birds, and fish en masse. For humans, this particularly makes sense, since the verse proceeds to talk about them in the plural. They may rule, indicating that a corporate focus is intended. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, the definite article is used because the subject, Adam, has already been introduced in the last verse. The use of the singular, created him, reflects the collective, which in Hebrew often uses singular modifiers, and the return to the plural, male and female, he created them, clarifies that one individual is not both male and female. For example, hermaphrodite. Genesis chapter 4, verse 25, does not have the definite article, though one would expect it because of its presence in the very similar statement in Genesis chapter 4, verse 1. By context, it cannot possibly be generic. The alternative is to take it as a personal name, which is inconsistent, because of Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, though not impossible. The editors of the modern critical edition of the Hebrew Bible contend that the article was inadvertently omitted in copying, though no Hebrew manuscripts offer the alternative. Genesis chapter 5, verse 1 contains two occurrences without the definite article. The first appears in the title and could be judged as a personal name in keeping with the titles of the same sort that occur throughout the book. The second one, however, seems anomalous. Nevertheless, once we realize that the verse is referring back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, the interpretation as a generic usage is logical. The three occurrences that feature the attached prepositions are pointed by the Masoretes as indefinite. They do not make sense as indefinite, and the form of the consonants could be either definite or indefinite. Like the modern editors of the critical edition of the Hebrew Bible, I would favor the definite form. Consequently, we find that the profile of Adam is complex rather than straightforward. These chapters are not just giving biographical information on a man named Adam. Larger statements are being made. When the generic is used, the text is talking about human beings as a species. When the definite article is being used, the referent is an individual serving as a human representative. Such representation could be either as an archetype. All are embodied in the one and counted as having participated in the acts of that one, or as a federal representative, in which one is serving as an elect delegate on behalf of the rest. In either case, the representational role is more important than the individual. Only in the cases where the word is indefinite and by context being used as a substitute for a personal name would the significance be tied to the individual as an individual historical person. The text itself gives us what we need to make these determinations. The use of the definite article tells us that Adam is being used to refer to something beyond the person. Then, the determination between archetype and federal representative is made based on the circumstances of the context. If what is being said of Ha-Adam, the form with the definite article, is true of all humans and not of just this one individual, then we can conclude that he serves there as an archetype. If, in contrast, the definite article is used and Ha-Adam is acting as an individual on behalf of others, we can conclude that he serves as federal representative. Proposition 7. The second creation account, Genesis chapter 2, verses 4 to 24, can be viewed as a sequel rather than as a recapitulation of day 6 in the first account. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 3. Most people reading Genesis chapters 1 and 2 believe that Genesis chapter 2, verse 7 begins a more specific account of what happened on day 6 of Genesis chapter 1, a recapitulation giving more detail. They draw this conclusion because day 6 reports the creation of humanity, and they see Genesis chapter 2 as a description of how God formed that first human being. That view understands Genesis chapter 2 as doubling back to elaborate on a part of Genesis chapter 1. Day 6. We need to examine whether such a conclusion is the only possibility. While it is easy to see how this conclusion can be drawn, one does not have to delve very deeply into the text to detect problems with that reading. First of all, there seem to be some problems in the order that is given for those who are inclined to interpret these texts as representing historical, material sequences. If Genesis chapter 2 is interpreted as a recapitulation, Genesis chapter 2 verses 5 to 6 is confusing. It says that there were no plants when God created humans. Yet, plants come on day 3 and humans on day 6 in Genesis chapter 1. Another sequence problem is that God created the animals first and then humans on day 6. In Genesis chapter 2, Adam is formed before the animals. The second problem exists for those who consider the days to be 24-hour days. That the events of Genesis chapter 2 could all take place in a 24-hour day, among them, naming all the animals, which apparently is completed because no helper was found, stretches credulity. Given these problems, it is worthwhile to go back and reconsider the question of whether Genesis chapter 2 is detailing day 6 or an event that comes later. Therefore, we must consider what evidences the text offers and whether it is possible to understand these two accounts as sequels. If they are sequels, we do not have to worry about fitting Genesis chapter 2 into day 6. But if they are sequels, it means that the people in Genesis chapter 1 may not be Adam and Eve, or at least not only Adam and Eve. The question would then be why we have a forming account like Genesis chapter 2 sometime after the creation of people as reported in Genesis chapter 1. Furthermore, if Genesis chapter 2 is a sequel, it would mean that there may be other people, in the image of God, in Genesis chapters 2 to 4, not just Adam and Eve and their family. That has certain advantages when interpreting Genesis chapter 4. In Genesis chapter 4, Cain has a wife. Genesis chapter 4, verse 17. The option that he has married his sister has never been an attractive one, though many have embraced it as seemingly the only possibility. We also find that Cain fears that whoever finds me will kill me. Genesis chapter 4, verse 14, when he is driven from the Lord's presence. Who is he afraid of? If he is driven away from the Lord's presence, then he is also being driven away from his family. This suggests that there are people other than his family in the land. Finally, we note that Cain builds a city. Genesis chapter 4, verse 17. The term city would not be appropriate unless it was a settlement of some size for many people. We would conclude then that the text actually implies that there are other people. We then have to explore how such an understanding of Genesis chapter 2 would make sense. Genesis chapter 2 verse 4 serves as an introduction to the second account. This is the account, Toledot, of the heavens and the earth when they were created, when the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. The literary formula, this is the account of X, occurs here and 10 other times in the book of Genesis. It stands as one of the formal characteristics of the book. In all the other occurrences in the book, the X is the name of a person. The formula introduces either a narrative of that person's sons or a genealogy of that person's descendants. In other words, it tells us about what came after that person, though it sometimes overlaps with the life of the person, and what developed from that person. In Genesis chapter 2 verse 4, it is not a person's name. Using the same logic, we would conclude that the section being introduced is going to talk about what came after the creation of the heavens and the earth, reported in the seven-day account, and what developed from that. In other words, the nature of the introduction leads us to think of Genesis chapter 2 as a sequel. That leads us to question what the usual relationship is between the texts on either side of the introductory formula. Most of the uses of the introduction transition to a sequel account. A few, however, do not. One example, Genesis chapter 5 verse 1 has parallel genealogies that are joined by the introductory formula. Yet, Genesis chapter 4, verses 25 to 26, has already returned to Adam, so the introduction technically transitions between Adam and his descendants, a sequel relationship. Three of the examples, Genesis chapter 11, verse 10, chapter 25, verse 19, and chapter 37, verse 2, can be identified as recursive. In each of these, the section before the transition follows a family line deep into later history. The introductory formula then returns the audience to the other son in the family, the more important one, to tell his story. In these cases, the text does not feature parallel genealogies like the lines of Cain and Seth, and the text does not bring the audience into the middle of the previous story to give a more detailed account. There is no detailed elaboration, even though there may be overlapping. The remaining six examples introduce sequel accounts. When we return to the relationship between Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2, we find that there is, therefore, no precedent by which to conclude that the introductory formula in Genesis chapter 2 verse 4 is bringing the audience back into the middle of the previous account to give a more detailed description of a part of the story that was previously told. Such introductions never do this in the rest of Genesis, and the word toledot, account, argues against such an understanding. Furthermore, Genesis chapter 2 does not follow the pattern of the recursive examples that follow a genealogy of the unfavored line before returning to the story of the favored line. This evidence then leads us to give strong preference to the view that Genesis chapter 2 is not adding further detail to what happened during the sixth day in Genesis chapter 1. It would therefore also mean that, though Adam and Eve may well be included among the people created in Genesis chapter 1, to think of them as the first couple, or the only people in their time, is not the only textual option. Regarding the role of Genesis chapter 2 verses 5 to 6, we note that the plants referred to in Genesis chapter 2 verse 5 are qualified, so as to indicate that they refer to cultivated crops rather than the general vegetation of Genesis chapter 1 available to the gatherer. After all, the land is generally being watered, so we would infer it is not totally without vegetation. In the discussion of Genesis chapter 1 verse 2, Tohu Vavohu, we examined the concept of an inchoate cosmos. Here, attention turns to an inchoate terrestrial setting, which is also well known from ancient Near Eastern cosmologies. One early second millennium text found at Nippur describes this setting with phrases such as the following. No water was drawn from the deep, nothing was produced. Enlil's great Ishib priest did not yet exist, sacred purification rites were not yet performed. The host of heaven was not yet adorned. Daylight did not yet shine. Night spread, but heaven had lit up his heavenly abode. The ground could not by itself make vegetation grow long. The gods of heaven and the gods of earth were not yet performing their duties. More focus on humankind is seen in a Sumerian text from Ur, dating to about 1600 B.C. The high plain was not being tilled. Canals, ditches, and dikes were not being built. No plowing was being done. Humans were not wearing clothes. Most notable is the description found in the Royal Chronicle of Lagash in relation to the recreation after the flood. After the flood had swept over and caused destruction of the earth, when the permanence of humanity had been assured and its descendants preserved, when the black-headed people had risen up again from their clay, and when, humanity's name having been given and government having been established, An and Enlil had not yet caused kingship, crown of the cities, to come down from heaven, and by, question mark, Ningirsu, they had not yet put in place the spade, the hoe, the basket, nor the plough that turns the soil, for the countless throng of silent people. At that time the human race, in its carefree infancy, had 100 years, but, without the ability to carry out the required work, its numbers decreased greatly. In the sheepfolds its sheep and goats died out. At this time water was short in Lagash. There was famine in Jirsu. Canals were not dug. Irrigation ditches were not dredged. Vast lands were not irrigated by Shaduf. Abundant water was not used to dampen meadows and fields, because humanity counted on rainwater. Ashnan did not bring forth dappled barley. No furrow was ploughed nor bore fruit. No land was worked nor bore fruit. No one used the plough to work the vast lands. These texts offer rich information for comparative studies, but, unfortunately, this is not the place for such a detailed study. Suffice it to say that, as always, such a study would have to take careful note of both the similarities and differences. For our purposes, we should note that the kind of description found in Genesis chapter 2, verses 5 to 6, is of the same sort that is common in cosmological texts of the ancient world, where a terrestrial pre-ordering condition is being described. Genesis is featuring the same sorts of discussions known in that world, though it often has a different perspective on them. We find in these texts that sometimes an inchoate terrestrial situation is discussed alongside an inchoate cosmic situation. But in other texts, the two are not treated together. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, an inchoate cosmos is described, whereas an inchoate earth is described in Genesis chapter 2, verses 5 to 6. This is another reason to locate Genesis chapter 2 chronologically after the 7 days, rather than in day 6. Applying this interpretation to Genesis chapters 1 to 2 would result in a number of conclusions. Genesis chapter 1 recounts the creation of all humanity in God's image, as it presents the idea that God has ordered sacred space to function on behalf of humanity. Genesis chapter 1 pertains to generic humanity, as indicated by the indefinite term used. This coincides well with the common way of reporting the creation of humans in the ancient world, so it is no surprise that generic humanity is the referent. Genesis chapter 1 does not report the mechanisms or processes used in that creative act, indicating only that it is an act of God. Just as Genesis chapter 1 began with a state of non-order in the larger cosmos, Genesis chapter 2 begins with a state of non-order in the terrestrial realm. Genesis chapter 2 explains how humans function in sacred space and on its behalf, in contrast to Genesis chapter 1, which addressed how sacred space functioned for humanity. Genesis chapter 2 locates the center of sacred space, the garden, in contrast to Genesis chapter 1, which only indicated that the cosmos was set up to be sacred space. The question remains as to the significance of Genesis chapter 2, if Genesis chapter 1 had already told about the creation of humanity. If Genesis chapter 2 comes sometime later, or even represents a different process, for example, individual focus versus corporate focus, why do we have forming accounts that could easily look like they describe the unique formation of the first human beings? These are the questions that we will take up in the next several chapters of the book. Proposition 8. Forming from dust and building from rib are archetypal claims and not claims of material origins. When people first become acquainted with my view of Genesis chapter 1 as an account of origins connected with order rather than material, summarized in the first several chapters, it is not long before they ask, But what about Genesis chapter 2? They go on to state what to them seems obvious, that forming is transparently a material term, and that dust is a material ingredient. It is therefore easy to conclude that even if Genesis chapter 1 is focused on order, at least here in Genesis chapter 2, we have an account of material human origins. Certainly, if the Bible is here making a claim about the mechanisms and process of material human origins, we would insist on taking that seriously. If we understand Genesis chapter 2 as an account of God making human beings in a quick and complete process, not developed materially from any previously existing species, we would be affirming a de novo creation of humans, and I will use that terminology throughout the rest of the book. The alternative to de novo is creation that features material continuity between species. In this book, we are not going to be discussing a scientific explanation of what happened. We are focusing our attention on what the Bible claims or does not claim. Even if we should discover that the Bible does not claim a de novo creation of humans, the scientific question would not be settled. We would still have to explore the options or explanations that science has to offer and consider them on their own merit. But if the Bible does not make a clear de novo claim, and thus does not rule out material continuity, then the Bible would not be inherently contradictory to scientific models that are based on material continuity. In other words, we could not reject the idea of material continuity by saying that the Bible rules it out by a competing theory that constitutes a mutually exclusive claim. Forming. We will first address the assumption that the word translated formed, Hebrew, itzor, necessarily implies a material act. The simple fact is that it does not, as usage demonstrates. One of the clearest examples is found in Zechariah chapter 12, verse 1. The Lord, who stretches out the heavens, who lays the foundations of the earth, and who forms, itzor, the human spirit within a person. Here the direct object of the verb is the human spirit, which is categorically not material. This demonstrates that forming is not essentially or necessarily a material act. This is not an isolated incident. In the 42 occurrences of the verb in the Hebrew Bible, it is used in a variety of non-material ways. God speaks of events that are taking place as having been formed, New International Version, planned, long ago. 2 Kings chapter 19, verse 25. Isaiah chapter 37, verse 26. Compared with Isaiah chapter 22, verse 11, chapter 46, verse 11, and Jeremiah chapter 18, verse 11. When God forms the heart, the statement is not referring to the blood pump, but to thoughts and inclinations. Psalm 33, verse 15. God formed summer and winter. Psalm 74, verse 17. A corrupt administration forms, New International Version, brings on, misery for the people through its decrees. Psalm 94, verse 20. Our days are formed, New International Version, ordained, by God. Psalm 139, verse 16. Israel is formed by God. Isaiah, chapter 43, verses 1 and 21, chapter 44, verses 2, 21, and 24, and chapter 45, verse 11. Jeremiah, chapter 10, verse 16, and chapter 51, verse 19. As a people, therefore not a material act. God forms light and creates darkness. Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7. Servant, having been identified as Cyrus, is formed by God in the womb. Isaiah chapter 49, verse 5, compared with Jeremiah chapter 1 verse 5, though he is born through a normal human process. God forms, New International Version, prepares, a swarm of locusts. Amos chapter 7 verse 1. More than half of the occurrences are shown by context to be unrelated to material. Many of the occurrences listed communicate how God ordains or decrees phenomena, events, destinies, and roles. Most of the occurrences not listed here could easily be translated by alternatives like prepare, ordain, or decree. This understanding corresponds precisely with the perspective of functional origins proposed in Genesis chapter 1. We therefore discover that our predisposition to understand form as a material act has more to do with the English translation than with the Hebrew original. Even those committed to literal interpretation must recognize that any literal interpretation must be based on Hebrew, not English. Dust. The other element that often leads us to think that Genesis chapter 2 verse 7 is speaking in material terms is the reference to dust, presumed by many to be a material ingredient. By now, however, we have learned that we must think this through before jumping to conclusions. The most basic way to think about dust would be to view it as part of the chemical composition of the human body. That approach immediately has several drawbacks. First, the Israelites would not be inclined to thinking in terms of chemistry. They would have no means to do that, and therefore, they had something else in mind as they considered this detail. Second, we would have to consider it flawed chemistry from our vantage point, in that dust could hardly be considered a primary ingredient of the human body. A common alternative to thinking in terms of chemistry is to understand the statement in the text as referring to craftsmanship. In this way of thinking, the imagery is of a hands-on God who has fashioned his creature with loving care and then bestowed on him the breath of life. The major problem with this is that the ingredient chosen would not make sense if the main idea were craftsmanship. One shapes clay, not dust. The latter is impervious to being shaped by its very nature. Therefore, we must look for another alternative, and there is no place better to look than in the text itself. We find the decisive clue in Genesis chapter 3, verse 19. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. Here we discover that dust refers to mortality. This association would make sense to an Israelite who was well acquainted with the idea of a corpse that was laid out on the slab in the family tomb and deteriorating to merely a pile of bones and the dust of the desiccated flesh within a year. Nevertheless, some have been reluctant to adopt this view because of a sense that other scriptural passages contradict it. Specifically, many have concluded that since Paul states that death came through sin, and in this way death came to all people because all sinned. Romans chapter 5 verse 12. People were created immortal. We must carefully consider whether this is what Paul is saying. Besides the likelihood that Genesis chapter 3 verse 19 suggests people were created mortal, another piece of evidence in Genesis offers even stronger evidence. In the garden, God provided a tree of life. Immortal people have no need for a tree of life. The provision of one suggests that they were mortal. Now, lest we think that Paul's statement might be out of sync with Genesis, we ought to look more carefully at what he is affirming. In Genesis, we find that people are cast from God's presence when they sin, and that a cherub is posted by the entry to the garden to prevent access to the tree of life. Genesis chapter 3, verse 24. If people were created mortal, the tree of life would have provided a remedy, an antidote to their mortality. When they sinned, they lost access to the antidote, and therefore were left with no remedy and were doomed to die, that is, subject to their natural mortality. In this case, Paul is saying only that all of us are subject to death because of sin. Sin cost us the solution to mortality, and so we are trapped in our mortality. He is therefore not affirming that people were created immortal, and is precisely in line with the information from Genesis. Some have objected that it would not be possible for God to say that creation was good if people were created mortal and there was death all around. As I have proposed previously, there is no sound reason to understand the good creation in that way. So we return to the proposition that dust, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, has the significance of indicating that people were created mortal. This interpretation stands in contrast to the all too facile modern presupposition that we must believe that formed from dust has scientific implications in order to take the text literally. Yet, it is perhaps odd that those same interpreters often do not apply the same understanding to Genesis chapter 2, verse 19, where the animals are formed out of the ground. More importantly, they rarely read scientific implications into Genesis chapter 1, verse 24. Let the land produce living creatures. Adam and the rest of us. The next question to consider is whether this statement about Adam pertains to him uniquely or to all of us. The core proposal of this book is that the forming accounts of Adam and Eve should be understood archetypally rather than as accounts of how those two individuals were uniquely formed. When I use the word archetype, I am not referring to the way that literature uses archetypes. I am referring to the simple concept that an archetype embodies all others in the group. An archetype in the Bible can well be an individual, and usually is. I am quite prepared to affirm the idea that Adam is an individual, a real person in a real past. Nevertheless, we have seen in the usage of the term Adam that the use of the definite article tends toward an understanding of Adam as a representative of some sort, and an archetype is one form of representation. Paul treats Adam as an archetype when he indicates that all sinned in Adam. Romans chapter 5, verse 12. In this way, we are all embodied in the One and counted as having participated in the acts of that One. In order to determine whether the treatment of Adam in the text focuses on him primarily as an archetype or as an individual, we can ask a simple question. Is the text describing something that is uniquely true of Adam, or is it describing something that is true of all of us? If only Adam is formed from dust, then it is treating him as a discrete and unique individual. If God only breathes the breath of life into Adam, he is thereby distinct from the rest of us. If Eve's formation conveys a truth about her that is true of her alone, then it is the history of an individual. If, however, any or all of these are true of all of us, it would cease being a reference to a unique, individual event and would have to be interpreted more broadly to capture its intended sense. When we begin to examine the evidence with these questions in mind, our findings may surprise us. First, we discover that all of us have the breath of life, in that it comes from God. Job, chapter 27, verse 3, chapter 32, verse 8, chapter 33, verse 4, chapter 34, verses 14 to 15, and Isaiah, chapter 42, verse 5. Then we discover that all creatures have the breath of life, presumably given by God. Genesis chapter 7, verse 22. But this is neither surprising nor controversial, and has little to do with the question of human origins. More significantly, as we examine the biblical evidence, we must conclude that we are all formed from dust. Psalm 103, verse 14 states, For he knows how we are formed. He remembers that we are dust. The vocabulary here, formed, dust, is the same as in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. Paul alludes to this universality when he contrasts the first man of dust and the second man of heaven, then indicates that all of us on earth share that dust identity. The first man was of the dust of the earth. The second man is of heaven. As was the earthly man, so are those who are of the earth. And as is the heavenly man, so are those who are of heaven. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 47 to 48. On the basis of biblical evidence, we must therefore conclude that all people are formed from dust. This is confirmed when we learn in Genesis chapter 3, verse 19, that dust is an expression of mortality. Dust we are, and to dust we will return. All of us share that mortality. We thus discover that Adam's formation from dust does not pertain uniquely to him. It pertains to all humans. Further evidence can be found in Job chapter 10, verse 9. Remember that you molded me like clay. Will you now turn me to dust again? Here, Job sees himself as molded by God, which is not a claim that he was not born of woman like everyone else. When the text reports Adam being formed from dust, it is not expressing something by which we can identify how Adam is different from all the rest of us. Rather, it conveys how we can identify that he is the same as all of us. Being formed from dust is a statement about our essence and identity, not our substance. In this, Adam is an archetype, not just a prototype. If we are all formed from dust, yet at the same time we are born of a mother through a normal birth process, we can see that being formed from dust, while true of each of us, is not a statement about each of our material origins. One can be born of a woman, yet still be formed from dust. All of us are. That means that even though Adam is formed from dust, he could still have been born of a woman. Formed from dust is not a statement of material origins for any of us, and there is no reason to think that it is a statement of Adam's material origins. For Adam, as for all of us, that we are formed from dust makes a statement about our identity as mortals. Since it pertains to all of us, it is archetypal. Special attention to Adam's forming is best connected to his role. In Egyptian iconography, we see reliefs of the pharaoh being formed on the potter's wheel by the god Khnum as part of the pharaoh's coronation. The gods have formed him to be king. In Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5, we learn that the prophet had been formed in the womb for a particular role, appointed as a prophet to the nations. These statements have to do with one's destiny and identity, not one's material origin. All the evidence points to understanding Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, in the same way. Adam's significance pertains to his role in the garden and what happened there. Given this reasoning, we have other alternatives beyond thinking that this is an account of material origins, and in these other options, Genesis would not be offering a competing claim to the scientific account of human origins. That does not mean the science is right. It means only that the Bible does not offer a competing claim. The Bible's claim is that whatever happened, God did it. He is the one responsible for our human existence and our human identity, regardless of the mechanisms or the time period. The Bible does not say clearly how he did it. Consequently, the Bible does not necessarily make a de novo claim for human origins, though it does make a claim that God is the ultimate cause of human origins. Rib. The first question to ask is whether the text suggests that Adam thought of Eve as having been built from his rib. The text gives us the answer. He did not. The first words out of his mouth were, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." Genesis chapter 2, verse 23. More than a rib is involved here because she is not only bone of his bone, but also flesh of his flesh. This leads us to ask then about the meaning of Genesis chapter 2, verse 21, which the New International Version translates, "He took one of the man's ribs and then closed up the place with flesh." Adam's statement leads us to inquire whether the translation rib is appropriate for the Hebrew word tzela. The word is used about 40 times in the Hebrew Bible, but it is not an anatomical term in any other passage. Outside of Genesis chapter 2, with the exception of 2 Samuel chapter 16 verse 13, referring to the other side of the hill, the word is only used architecturally in the tabernacle slash temple passages. Exodus chapters 25 to 38, 1 Kings chapters 6 to 7, Ezekiel chapter 41. It can refer to planks or beams in these passages, but more often it refers to one side or the other, typically when there are two sides, rings along two sides of the ark, rooms on two sides of the temple, the north or south side, etc. On the basis of Adam's statement, combined with these data on usage, we would have to conclude that God took one of Adam's sides, likely meaning he cut Adam in half and from one side built the woman. When we investigate the Hebrew word and the way it has been handled throughout history, we discover much supporting evidence for this perspective, beginning with the way that the cognate tselu is used in Akkadian, Assyrian, and Babylonian. We find that the word has a certain ambiguity. Rarely, it refers to a single rib. Most times, it refers to the entire side or to the entire rib cage. This is comparable to our English use when we talk about a side of beef. When we turn our attention to early translations, we find that the Aramaic translation in the Targums, Aramaic, il, can refer to either rib or side. And the same is true of the word chosen by the translators of the Septuagint. Greek plura can be either rib or side. In the Latin Vulgate, Jerome used the Latin word costis, which can be either rib or side. One of the earliest discussions found in the rabbinic literature is in the comments in Midrash Rabbah by Rabbi Samuel ben Namani, who was already arguing the use of side instead of rib. By the time we finally get to the period of English translations, the interpretation rib has become entrenched. Wycliffe Bible, Geneva Bible, Great Bible, and King James Version. Based on the lexical information, however, we can see that this is an interpretation from a word that in Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, and Latin could mean either side or rib. Adam's own statement and the more dominant use of the word both suggest that side would be the better choice. This conclusion poses a conundrum for us. If God cut Adam in half, that is pretty radical surgery. Certainly, God can do whatever he wants, but would Israelites naturally think in terms of surgery? Would they think that Adam was anesthetized when God put Adam in a deep sleep? Israelites knew nothing of the use of anesthesia, and if God were going to perform such a profound miracle, he could simply make Adam impervious to pain. In fact, many would claim that there was no pain before the fall, thereby rendering anesthesia unnecessary. The text, however, leads us in another direction. We need to examine the word deep sleep, tardema, from radam. The noun occurs seven times, and the verbal root from which it is drawn another seven times. We find that the sleep the word describes could be used in three different sorts of circumstances. One, When someone is unresponsive to circumstances in the human realm, induced by something in the human realm, Sisera's exhaustion and warm milk. Judges, chapter 4, verses 19 and 21. Horse and charioteer in the sleep of death. Psalm 76, verse 6. Sloth wrought by laziness. Proverbs, chapter 19, verse 15, compared with Proverbs, chapter 10, verse 5. 2. When someone is unresponsive to circumstances in the human realm, and equally unresponsive to deity. Saul, 1 Samuel, chapter 26, verse 12. Faithless Israel, Isaiah, chapter 29, verse 10. Jonah, John, chapter 1, verses 5 to 6. 3. When someone has become unresponsive to the human realm in order to receive communication from the divine realm. Abraham, Genesis chapter 15, verse 12. Eliphaz, Job chapter 4, verse 13. Daniel chapter 8, verse 18, and chapter 10, verse 9, compared with Job chapter 33, verse 15. Michael Fox adds the insight that the word pertains to untimely sleep or stupefaction, not to normal sleep at night. In all three categories, this sleep blocks all perception in the human realm. In each of these passages, there is either danger in the human realm of which the sleeper is unaware, or there is insight in the visionary realm to be gained. Pertaining to the latter possibility, it is of interest that the Septuagint translators chose to use the Greek word ekstasis in Genesis chapter 2, verse 21. This word is the same as the one they used in Genesis chapter 15, verse 12, suggesting an understanding related to visions, trances, and ecstasy, compared with the use of this Greek word in Acts chapter 10, verse 10, chapter 11, verse 5, and chapter 22, verse 17. New International Version, trance. This interpretation is also evident among the Church Fathers, Ephrem, Tertullian. From the Vulgate, Jerome chose the Latin word sopor, which refers to any sort of abnormal sleep, including that which comes about in trances. From these data, it is easy to conclude that Adam's sleep has prepared him for a visionary experience rather than for a surgical procedure. The description of himself being cut in half and the woman being built from the other half, Genesis chapter 2 verses 21 to 22, would refer not to something he physically experienced, but to something that he saw in a vision. It would therefore not describe a material event, but would give him an understanding of an important reality, which he expresses eloquently in Genesis chapter 2 verse 23. Consequently, we would then be able to conclude that the text does not describe the material origin of Eve. The vision would concern her identity as ontologically related to the man. The text would therefore have no claim to make about the material origin of woman. Furthermore, once we see that gender identity is under discussion, we conclude that the text is not expressing something that is true about Eve alone. It is true of all womankind. This interpretation is confirmed in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, where the text offers an observation that is true of all mankind and all womankind. Again, the archetypal element is clear because what has transpired pertains to all, not just uniquely to Adam and Eve. All womankind is from the side of all mankind. Marriage is being rejoined and recovering humanity's original state. This should not be mistaken to infer that someone who does not marry is less than a whole person, or that there is a particular spouse that is your other half. The text is referring generically to the corporate human race that is ontologically gendered. Genesis chapter 2 verse 24 is responding to the question of why a person would leave the closest biological relationship, parents to children, in order to forge a relationship with a biological outsider? The answer offered is that marriage goes beyond biology to recover an original state, for humanity is